Okay, welcome back from your weekends. This is our Monday scramble. A little bit later in the show, we'll talk about the mini blackout in New York with two exciting young correspondents. And we'll also talk about how it relates to and occurred on the anniversary of the 1977 Maxi blackout. And then at the end of the show, Dave Zirin from The Nation is going to join us, a great sports writer, going to talk about why baseball is losing audience and what can be done, if anything, to save baseball. But right now, we have a Connecticut journalism legend in the studio right now with me, John Lender, a Hartford Current investigative reporter who writes the weekly Government Watch column. And we're going to be talking about the Connecticut Lottery Corporation. So I think what we need to do is to, before we get to the latest developments, which you've been breaking over the last 2 weeks in your column, we need to sort of set this up because not everybody understands this story. So I'm going to try to set it up and you're going to just keep telling me I got it wrong or whatever.
I appreciate you doing this, by the way.
Okay. So I think it goes back to 2015, 2016. And so what happens eventually is that Ann Noble, who's the CEO of the Connecticut Lottery Corporation, and John, let's pause here and talk about what the Connecticut Lottery Corporation is. It's not a state agency, but it's also not a state agency.
Yeah, it's a quasi-public. And I write about these things and you talk about them. They have all the powers and abilities of state agencies, but more independence to run themselves. And, you know, the cliche is we'll run it like a business. Mm-hmm. And what comes with that is a lack of accountability on things like freedom of information. And
although they are subject to FOI. Right?
They are, but yeah, they just don't always
they don't know
what they're supposed to do. Yeah. Some of them are worse than others.
Right. So that's what the Connecticut Lottery Corporation is. They're the wonderful people who bring you all your scratchy tickets and your all that kind of stuff. They are nominally anyway sort of a state agency. So there's a big investigation, 2015, 2016. There's been a breach in the lottery software that allowed lottery agents to manipulate terminals to produce more winning lottery tickets, which is a pretty significant problem. And it turns out that Ann Noble, then the CEO of the Connecticut Lottery Corporation, knew about this for a while and didn't really tell it. I mean, she kept it inside the agency that for a long time. I mean, this kind of thing you'd want your superiors in the state government to know and maybe the public, but they didn't tell anybody, right?
She would argue with that, but she did not, you know, stand on the rooftop and tell the public that this was going on. And so this boomeranged on her because you have the Department of Consumer Protection, which is the regulator of the lottery. The Department of Consumer Protection started looking into it. And they said, hey, you know, this stuff has been going on for a while. And you know, the great thing about that scandal with five-card cash was the ingenuity of the lottery agents at the convenience stores. They had a way of overloading the computer system with, you know, how do you get from Enfield to Rocky Hill or whatever. Anything, any instruction that would slow it down. Mm-hmm. So they could actually, and they had a readout for what the last sale was, except they'd get the readout before the ticket came out so they could see if it was a winner.
Right.
And they'd let it come out if it was a winner and they'd pay for it and put it aside. And if it was a loser, they'd just cancel the transaction. It was really an interesting thing.
So when we say ingenuity, it's not necessarily ingenuity that
criminal ingenuity.
Criminal ingenuity. Okay, so just to
like
keep going
Lex
here.
Lex Luthor.
So eventually, Noble, because of all this, she resigns. But then there's another
problem.
She
would dispute that, too. She had, you know, other places she wanted to be.
Okay, so she can travel more or whatever. But this horrible thing has happened. She winds up resigning. And actually, the chairman of the state lottery board at that point, Frank Farriker, even says at one point that he's trying to, in a confidential memo, that he's trying to keep the state investigation into the scandal-plagued lottery game under wraps. While the board is negotiating the controversial and lucrative severance package with CEO Ann Noble.
I know. How many times do I use that word? But yeah.
So what you've got is the CEO is resigning. She's getting, I don't know if she would dispute this part, she's getting a terrific deal for somebody who's resigning in less than glorious circumstances.
It was amazing. And she needed 4 months to get to 10 years, which is a big milestone for your retirement benefits. And so they put her in this arrangement where she was an employee of the board. It'd never been done before, you know, and it kept her on the payroll as kind of a hybrid consultant employee. And anyway, she.
So, yeah, so after she hits that vestiture, she, for months thereafter, for like 20, 25 grand a month,
that's right.
She's a consultant. Yep. Once again, whatever she might say about this, this is not a person who's resigning at the top of her game. This is a person who's resigning at the time where one of the lottery's games has had to be pulled offline.
Yeah, it had to be canceled.
It had to be, right. The whole game had to be scrapped because it was so completely tainted. All right. So then Frank Farriker, who is the unpaid chairman of the Board of Trustees, steps into an interim job, her old job.
Mm-hmm.
And
so he's both the board chairman of the governing board and now the CEO.
Right. And a couple of things happen. One of them is it turns out he's actually kind of interested in this high-paying CEO, you know, 200.
Yeah, he was trying to, behind the scenes, he was trying to get the job. That's right.
And then also another problem is he's billing the state for all this stuff, like his, I don't know, his cable package. And,
yeah, he was saying, you know, I'm working from home a lot and I'm helping the state and I need my
internet.
Yeah, but I can't get the internet without, you know, all this other stuff without the cable TV.
Yeah, so it's the bundling. It's the bundling. We all have that problem, you know?
So
he didn't want Hulu. I know. He just was part of what he needed to be a CEO.
Anyway, he got in trouble for it. He had to pay a $5,000 fine and make thousands of restitution.
Yeah. It was the total was like $11,000.
Oh, good.
Something.
You got that in front of you.
So yeah, I've been putting together a timeline. Okay, so this is where my timeline stops, and you have to pick up the story from there. So there's, I mean, so now they've got a new CEO who wants to turn things around, but there's still all this stuff still from the past percolating around, and that's where you come in.
I have to introduce. Another name.
All right.
Alfred Dupuy.
Dupuy. Yeah. Forget about him, yeah.
Yeah, and
security chief.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And a big job, like one of the top executives there, $139,000 a year. And, you know, after everything that came before that we just talked about, on January 1st of 2018, there was a New Year's super drawing where, you know, for some odd reason, they number the tickets, not 00001. Somebody had the idea years ago that it would make the game seem more popular if they started with ticket 100,001. So there was a group, and so they had about, I don't know, a dozen. I think it was number 14, I think it was. They're periodic, like 6 months at a time. And for this drawing, the people who did the drawing, and they have to punch the range of numbers into what's this computer box called a random number generator, and because it started at 100,001, the upper range, they take the number of tickets that were sold, and I can't really recall exactly how many there were. It was a couple hundred thousand at least, and what they had to do when they put in the range of numbers for the computer brain to select the winners from. They're supposed to, at the top, take the number of tickets sold and add 100,000. Mm-hmm. Well, they forgot to do that.
Right.
And so
So basically roughly half of the tickets that were bought were never considered as by the computer to be randomly chosen.
Yeah, yeah. I'd hate to have been the person whose responsibility it was who noticed, hey, there are no winners up in the upper range. And they knew right away what had happened. Anyway, so it's a long story. I'll try to make it short. They had to do a do-over lottery.
Mm-hmm.
Which they had different options they could have done. They could have had theoretically just another lottery drawing just for the 100,000 people who were excluded, but they didn't do that. They did it a whole new drawing 2 weeks later, and there were repercussions because of this. Several people who were actually the people who did the drawing, the programming of the number generator, got suspended. And Fred Dupuy, who actually ran the second drawing and it went off without a hitch, got a disciplinary letter in mid-February of that year and said, you're on a paid leave and you can come back. You're ordered to come back a week later and face discipline up to and including termination. And he didn't come back. He never came back. He just took leave, you know, family leave, whatever, sick leave, and used up all his leave. And then November that year, he ended up retiring. He was old enough to. And anyway, he In the midst of his leaves, he filed a complaint with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities, and that led to hearings that are still going on now that were going on last week. So, you know, I have to update the story. I was just going to go and go to two hearings last week, Tuesday and Wednesday. You know, all right, something's going to come out of that, and I can work on other things that are, you know, more effort, and I can just let this thing happen in front of me, and I'll update the story. And then what happens is, two things. Frank Farriker testifies in the morning, and he testifies in support of Fred Dupuy's claim that he's being, they have a vendetta against him for revelations behind the scenes he made with the five-card cash problem. The lottery denies that, and Chelsea Turner denies that. And Chelsea Turner, by the way—
New character, Chelsea Turner.
Oh, yeah, thanks. Chelsea Turner is the vice president of the lottery, and she actually worked in the REL governor's office for about a year at the same time as Ann Noble. So like 9 years ago, when the REL administration was ending and everybody over there needed a job, Ann Noble, who by then had become the executive director and CEO, CEO, president at the lottery, created a position and took her in, and you know, she was had skills as a lobbyist and at the Capitol, and she was like ended up being the director of legislative affairs. Anyway, so now Chelsea survived all through these years of turmoil, and now she's the vice president of the lottery, 190,000. Yeah, 190,000.
It's a good job. 190K.
Yeah, excellent. So anyway, Farriker, the former chairman and CEO who wanted that job himself but didn't end up getting it, testifies in the morning that last Tuesday that Fred Dupuy is correct when he says that Chelsea Turner wanted to get rid of him. And he said that, you know, I think he said the first day I was on the job as the interim CEO, you know, she came to me and said, Fred's got to go for this reason. He's not a team player or whatever. And
he remembered it because he'd seen something on his cable TV that day that he could, yeah. He could peg to it.
Yeah.
All right, continue.
And anyway, so Chelsea comes on in the afternoon, and her attorney, you know, redirects or whatever, and she says that just never happened, you know, and I never trusted Frank Farriker. I didn't trust him then. I don't trust him now. You know. So, and the attorney said, well, you know, when you had these suspicions and you thought he had like tried to, you know, do unethical things, you know, who did you report it to? Did you report it to the State Ethics Commission, which is the place that you're supposed to report things? And she said, no. You know, he was now the boss of my boss's boss. This is at a time when Ann Noble was still
the CEO. Frank Farriker would have been chairman of the board.
At that time. And she said, so I didn't do that. I talked with some members of the board, and whether she talked with them individually or it was mostly individually, I guess. But anyway, then the attorney for Fred Dupuy, Eric Brown, says, well, apart from talking to these board members, did you talk to anyone else about your suspicions of the alleged nefarious behavior? She said, yes. And he said, well, who? And she says, the FBI. Now here, you know, I'm used to these things droning on. You know, when people think of any court proceeding, if you've never covered court, this is an administrative proceeding, but it's quasi, well, I hate to use that word again, but judicial, you know.
They're very boring.
They're not like Perry Mason.
No.
You know, so anyway, this actually was a Perry Mason moment, right? Yeah. And now I start, I got to listen to this. And he says, the FBI, what? She says, well, I have this friend in the FBI and Special Agent Jennifer Burry, who works for the FBI in Connecticut, and I went to college with her. So I felt like it was a safe space to go through. That's what she said, a safe space. And, you know, rather than risking repercussions inside, whatever. So she went there. It's very, you know, I tried to get her to clarify it afterwards, and she didn't really want to say any more about it once it was in a break during the hearing. So what she testified to is, and I don't know if we have all the dots here, was that Jennifer Berry, the FBI agent she went to, who her friend, put her in touch with another agent. And then further questions from Brown, the attorney, she says, yeah, well, I wasn't the only one either. Oh, who else? Ann Noble did, went to the FBI too. And it turned out that she, in effect, wore a wire. She said wiretapped, but we figured, you know, it came out that
it was funner than that.
Well, it was.
She went and saw Q and got like some special thing.
That's right. It was an eyeglass case. And, you know, on Tuesday, briefly, she had her eyeglass case with her. And she said it was a case like this. And I'm just trying to keep track of everything, right? And I realized afterwards, why didn't I take a picture of that, right?
Yeah.
And, but luckily the next day, on Wednesday, I went back and she had it with her.
Right. So this is an eyeglass case with a microphone inside it.
Either a microphone, maybe a little recorder. That was it.
And so
Ann Noble had a meeting, at least one meeting, with Frank Farriker, and presumably asked him questions that would, whatever she suspected him of, he would talk about. The things that raised Chelsea Turner's suspicions were, a deal that Farriker had the lottery make with the Mohegan Sun, some promotional deal, and that Farriker had ordered her, who handled all the lobbying with the legislature. They can't really call it lobbying because if quasi-publics can't have a lobbyist, but trying to get on Keno, told her hands off that. And so that made her suspicious, and so it went nowhere, basically.
The FBI investigation went nowhere, right?
It appears not to. How many times Farriker might have been recorded, who else might have been recorded. We don't know the context for the FBI interest in it. I mean, lots of times you have a full-blown investigation.
We should say that you can get that kind of recording permission without full probable cause because one party agrees to it.
Yeah. I was surprised to see that. But yeah, that's right. Yeah it's called consensual monitoring.
Right.
If one of the parties is...
So anybody you're talking to for the rest of the day, for the rest of your life, they might be have a microphone inside their glasses case.
That's right. I've got a lot of jokes around the office in the last couple of days.
They wouldn't have to go to a judge or anything. I mean, it seems to me, John, we're talking to John Linder, investigative reporter for the Hartford Courant. I mean, it's hard to say what all this is other than a continuation of this long-running, highly dysfunctional situation. We should say it. There is a new CEO. There was Ann Noble. Mm-hmm. Ann Noble resigned. And then briefly, Frank Farriker was the acting CEO.
And after Farriker quit, then for, 8 months or so, or a few months anyway, Chelsea Turner was the acting
interim director. Yeah. And now there's Greg Smith, who's now running the thing. Let's hear how Greg Smith sees the future, the glorious future of the Connecticut Lottery Corporation.
My goal as the new leader of this organization is to reestablish positive cooperation with the Department of Consumer Protection, the legislators, the administration, and our key vendors. The Connecticut Lottery has been an effective and efficient source of funding for the state for almost 50 years. Last year, we returned about $345 million to the state and are ahead of that pace for this current fiscal year.
So, one theme that I think has emerged here, there are a few themes that have emerged in your reporting, John. One of them is that at the Connecticut Lottery Corporation, they kind of do whatever they want to do as opposed to whatever the rules would be. And I mean, a few instances of this, when Ann Noble did retire and got this incredible sweetheart deal where money was trickled towards her so she could get up to the point of retirement vestiture, and then this like extra, consulting contract piled on top of that, the state auditors, who are often a voice of sanity and clarity in situations like this, they went nuts. They said this is part of a pattern where people resign under less than ideal circumstances and yet get all kinds of things that are special favors. And one thing they pointed out was there's something called the State Retirement Commission where you can check out whether what you're doing makes any sense or not, or whether it conforms to rules and guidelines. But they don't bother to do that. And now here's Chelsea Turner. She thinks that there's something wrong with a former acting director, chairman of the board. She could go to the Ethics Commission. She could go to the auditors. There's a lot of places she could go. You don't freaking call the FBI up just because you've got this idea.
Not normally.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, Smith, the day after the story of what we've been talking about hit the paper, actually put out a memo to all employees and said, you know, it has come up that there are some things that were reported, you know, and he talked about two former lottery people, Frank Farriker and Ann Noble, didn't name them. He said nothing about Chelsea, who, like, according to her testimony, had a critical role in what happened. But he said, here are the people you go to if you have some wrongdoing you want to report. State Ethics Commission, the ethics officer, et cetera. You know, none of the places he said were the FBI, you know, where Ann Noble and Chelsea Turner apparently went. So here you have, you know, you wouldn't normally think a bureaucratic quasi-public would be an ideal setting for a soap opera.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it's more a melodrama than a drama, really.
So as we begin to wrap up this incredibly complicated story, although it's going to consume the next couple of years of John's life, but, I mean, the rest of us can go back to our business. But, I mean, I think you've got a few problems here. One of them is, you know, in terms of really out-and-out malfeasance, other than way back in 2015, where it turns out that these retail agents have figured out a way to game the game, you know, I mean, that was wrong. They were doing something wrong. It's what we have here are perhaps some people who don't trust each other, people who have suspicions of one another. But it seems like it's been more incompetence and backbiting and stuff. I mean, I don't see anywhere else in here proof that somebody's I see suspicions, but it's like it seems like a really unhealthy office culture where nobody trusts anybody else.
Yeah, I mean, Governor Lamont, in his first comment on it, said he was concerned by the continual or dysfunctional management. And that's his first, you know, he first waded into this after this thing happened.
Right. And I think the other problem here is, you know, for the most part, we don't interact with that many state agencies unless we have a special reason to. So if you have a special need and that agency addresses that need, then you do. Other than that, it's like DMV every once in a while. It's the state cops if you get pulled over or, you know, but the lottery, the Connecticut Lottery Corporation, a quasi-public, is one where people all the time hand over some money and get a ticket back with the expectation that they're participating in a game that is fairly and competently run, and the state depends on these revenues, which are considerable. I mean, a large amount of money.
Yeah, $345 million a year.
So you don't want to jeopardize that amount of money by a situation where people look at this and go, "Well, is this being done right at all? Would I be better off?" You know,
it's very interesting. You know, I know a lot of people who play the lottery games, and trust is by far the most important thing, and yet, even with all of this stuff happening, people play. And so it's hard. It's one of these situations where it's like, how do you, the lottery says, hey, we're breaking records. Well, you know, how do you stop Niagara Falls from from flowing? I mean, who knows exactly if they could be doing better, you know, with revenue? I don't know. But, you know, just for example, they were talking about getting rid of the comical, I like them, the little ping pong ball machines.
Right, yes.
You know? And they were talking about putting it in a random number generator.
These are the little balls that pop up on air currents, you know, when you see them.
Yeah.
And yeah, I thought that was really stupid too, because it's like one of the few things that does engender some confidence.
I know people who actually will stop what they're doing. They're playing cards at night. No, I want to watch the drawing. Yeah. And even if you don't watch it, knowing that is a harder thing to fix. And, you know, there was a guy out in the Midwest, I forget his name right now, Eddie something, weighed like 450 pounds, sat at home, and he hacked into things and created programs for the random number generator.
Yeah, hackable. We should say that Governor Lamont has proposed as a middle ground that John be the person who picks up the balls and reads the numbers. And I would have more confidence in that if you were to do that. We're going to have to stop there, John Linder, but everybody should continue to read John Linder's excellent reporting. Hartford Current investigative reporter par excellence, keeping them honest in the weekly Government Watch column. He's going to be writing about the Connecticut Lottery Corporation. They're going to have to extend his retirement date so he can just continue this story until it ultimately ends with the death of civilization. All right. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
All right. We're going to go to the blackout after this, the New York blackout, with our super young Mod Squad correspondents. All right. So what, 42 years ago, 1977, there was a massive, massive legendary blackout in the city of New York. All kinds of things happened. There was culture. There were stories. There were movies, stuff like that. I don't know if what happened this weekend is going to be the same. And it wasn't quite as big of a blackout anyway. It affected just a portion of Manhattan itself. But we're going to tell you a little bit more about it through the eyes of two exciting young correspondents. We have with us from the studios in New York, Brendan J. Sullivan, writer-producer, who's toured the world as Lady Gaga's DJ and written about the New York City blackout, and has written books, and he's the commissioner of our Song of the Summer program. But before we get to Brendan, it turns out that Carmen Baskoff, who is everywhere all the time, as far as I can tell, Where We Live producer, was in Manhattan during Saturday evening's blackout. So in your own words, you were at a comedy improv show, I believe?
Yes, I was. Yeah, so I'd gone down with my sister and my roommate, actually, to see some improv comedy in Hell's Kitchen, and apparently just a block or two from the edge of the blackout. So we'd gone there. Everything was working fine. They were doing the kind of, like, get inspiration by asking people in the audience weird stuff that happened. And a couple mentioned, oh, there was this blackout at our hotel and it seemed to have followed us down to the theater. And so they're making a bunch of jokes. The whole sort of comedy show mm-hmm. was around, haha, blackout. And then yeah. we all eventually emerged from the theater and realized, oh, there, in fact, is a massive blackout.
Right. The actual city of New York yes-anded you, basically.
Exactly.
And we should say that, so this is all kind of around the Midtown area of New York. We should also say that New York being New York, it didn't take this lying down. There are all kinds of impromptu performances going on, including the cast of Hadestown goes out in front of their theater because the theaters, I guess, are kind of emptying out onto the streets. You're going to hear the legendary and Tony-winning Andre DeShields improvising with the trombone lick that opens a Hadestown as this crowd of people are just standing out on the street. All right, so let's go over to Commissioner Brendan J. Sullivan. You, I believe, as this was happening, were actually departing Manhattan for one of the other boroughs, correct?
Yes. I was on the train on the bridge when right as you got on the over the bridge, sort of everyone pulls out their phone because you have service, and all of a sudden everyone was talking about how the blackout was happening just behind us. So we all cram over to the windows, and it's like, you know, it looks like a chunk of the island is missing.
Right. What are the differences between then and now? And Carmen, I think you participated in this, is, you know, in 1977, we were just kind of relying on news reporting and it was a pretty confusing situation. But everybody has a freaking phone right now. So I saw you, right? You were doing some videos, Carmen?
Yeah. So I actually, for most of the time I was in the blackout zone, my internet on my phone wasn't working, but still had cell text. So we were calling people who were outside of the blackout zone and getting like reports on like how far the subways were affected. And then actually when I got to the edge of the blackout zone, I popped on a Wi-Fi from one of the stores and posted a video.
All right. So this is the way that we live now. So Brendan, the way that you saw it from a train, subway train on a bridge, wink, 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 the things are going out. I mean, that's kind of disaster movie footage in a way. Were you scared at all? Were you worried?
I've been through a couple blackouts in New York. My most recent one was also the last time I had to go to Bradley Airport, and it was Hurricane Sandy. I was DJing in the Hamptons, and I had to turn right around to get to Canada for a gig, and it was like Edmonton, you know, in the middle of nowhere. All the airports were blown out. And so I had to drive to Connecticut to Bradley Airport, which was the closest airport. And I said to myself on the way over, well, you know, I want to see what's going on in Manhattan. I got to see this. So I'm going to drive over the bridge. And I like almost wish I didn't, because it is terrifying. You wouldn't think it is, because everything's blacked out. So you can't really, you would think your car headlights would take care of all that. But people crossing the street, you can't see them as you would with, when there's street lights on. Some people would try and carry a flashlight, but you can sort of only see them then. And you look up and it's just stone. You're just in shadow. And, you know, just being on a side street, it could take you 10 minutes to make a left because no one can see you and stop for you.
Right. So we should say that one of the people who emerged, well, first of all, we should say that Mayor de Blasio, because he's a candidate for president, was in Iowa, at least for the beginning of this, right? So one of the people who emerged kind of in that vacuum is the New York City Council Speaker, Corey Johnson. Let's hear a little bit of Corey Johnson talking to the people on Fox 5.
The thing people want is they want accurate, calm, responsibly communicated information to them. And that's what I tried to provide. I was on the phone with the Office of Emergency Management, on the phone with leadership at the MTA, and I was calling the CEO of Con Edison, getting any information I could so that people who were affected by this pretty widespread blackout would know what was going on.
So, Brendan, did Corey Johnson become kind of the star of the blackout?
He was. Corey Johnson is such an important and interesting figure for this day and age. A millennial politician, a Chelsea resident. That's his neighborhood. When he was as a city council member, that was his neighborhood right there, Chelsea, on the way up to Midtown. And he has just sparkled in the last year or so. He is a Twitter celebrity. Every day for the last 3 months, he's been talking about his quest to quit smoking and the whole thing. You'll look at a backlog there, yeah, and you'll see like AOC tweeting at him like, good job, buddy, keep it up. People just love this guy.
Well, he's very open about having quit other substances in the past as well, right?
Yes, exactly, yes, which would ruin someone trying to become mayor of another city. But he's very open about his HIV status, about his relationship status, and he's just a very honest and different kind of candidate.
You know, we should say, Carmen, you know, people who don't go to New York a lot, I think they get ideas about what New York is like and whether it's a scary place to be. One thing you saw a lot of was people trying to be helpful, talk about what they were doing with their cell phone lights.
Yeah, there was, so obviously all the traffic lights were out, which is a potential for a lot of chaos. And there was just a lot of helpful citizen volunteers who'd gone out into the middle of intersections and were using their, cell phone flashlight or cell phone screen kind of to direct traffic and, just sort of taking charge and leading people. I saw at one point there was two guys. One guy, I think he just got off a bicycle, was wearing his like bicycle helmet, and he's like, maybe we should, switch to the other direction of traffic. And so they were about to do that. And the other guy's like, oh, no, there's some emergency vehicles coming. We better, keep traffic moving this way. But it's just like, yeah, people who I guess were in place and thought, I can do something to help.
And a man giving out ice cream, right?
And yeah, there's an ice cream shop I passed where obviously all their ice cream was melting. So they were, sharing ice cream with people coming by.
So, Brendan, just to contrast that, okay, in 77, when the big blackout hit, first of all, New York was in a lot more trouble. It wasn't a healthy city at that time. You're 2 years past the famous Ford to NYC drop dead headline, but still problems. And it's just a full, massive blackout. And one of the things, one of the cultural theories that has come out of this is that hip-hop, which was just a barely known name at the time, that hip-hop, for peculiar reasons, may have gathered momentum and steam as a result of the 77 blackout. Go ahead and say some more about that.
Yeah, it was an interesting time in the city. About 5,000 police officers had just been laid off when the city was trying to, right this ship. There was a mayoral election coming up. And at the same time, you had these, the Bronx disco scene was led by crews of DJs just because of the logistics of it. Two turntables, mixer, big system. These were vinyl records, so you needed a crew of people so you could have those two copies on vinyl. And this is where all of hip-hop culture comes from. So, when you extend the break in the song, when, you imagine James Brown going over to the drummer and then in the, saying, hit me, and then the audience is going nuts, and you have, instead of guys joining gangs and street gangs, they're in dance crews, and they are trying to see who can dance the best, who can do the best graffiti, who can rhyme the best. And out of that culture came these MCs who would just whip up the crowd in classic, radio style, just trying to make a little rhyme over the break there. And this would have just kept becoming maybe a little fad, maybe a niche thing, sort of like at the same time in D.C., there was a somewhat similar kind of music called Go-Go.
Go-Go, yeah.
The samples from Nelly's Hot in Here come from Go-Go Records, not from disco records. So it could have just been another very forgettable music scene full of people you've never heard of from a part of the, you know, the Bronx, a place you would never go, and suburban kids who are their biggest audience wouldn't go. But then lightning literally struck twice. The blackout of 77, two separate lightning bolts that just cut the city off from all power. And when you imagine the people that were affected by this, they were kids. These are the babies of the baby boom. These are kids who are watching TV. They're watching Happy Days, and they see all these happy people in the suburbs. But in the Bronx, their funding is getting cut for schools. And what goes first? It's, of course, music. It's art. So kids who normally might have had another outlet are out in the streets, and they don't have bands. They don't have art, but they do have graffiti, and they do have these parties, which are happening not in big discos or fancy nightclubs. They're happening in parks. You know, people are famously, if you had a flathead screwdriver, you could pry open the bottom of a streetlight and plug your stereo system into it.
Yeah, well, I should say that on that night, DJ Grandmaster Kaz and Disco Wiz had done exactly that. They'd plugged their turntables and system illegally into a light post. And when the blackout hit, they thought they'd done it. They didn't realize how pervasive the blackout was. So imagine their turntable starts to slow down because there's no power. And then all the lights go out. And they thought they'd knocked out the power, at least in that neighborhood anyway. It took them a while to realize it was way, way bigger than that.
But the moment after that, I've heard that story too, and I heard they all looked at each other like, and they looked at their dance audience and said, don't even think about it, and they grabbed their equipment and tried to get out of there.
Right.
But all over the city, people were looting, and they were taking, you know, imagine just being so angry, or being so, having lived through a city that was defaulted on, where the president says, drop dead, basically, the famous headline. And all of a sudden, everything you've ever wanted, you know, you turn on TV and it's, you need new clothes, you need a new car, you need this, and there's not even jobs in your neighborhood. And then all of a sudden, the power goes out and the cops are overwhelmed. There would be two and three people handcuffed in the back seat. One detective said they all had TVs on their laps in the back because that was the only way to collect evidence, and they had to put another guy in the trunk. So a lot of the next day, I'm not accusing anyone of looting here. I'm just saying somehow the next day, a lot of wannabe DJs finally had two turntables, and a lot of pretty good DJs now had recording equipment, and
right.
A lot of MCs had a microphone. And other than that, so that's where all our original hip-hop records are coming from. And when you listen to something like, you know, Rapper's Delight, which sort of came out of that era, it's a 1979 track from Rhymes in that era, you don't hear people emulating their favorite rappers. You hear them talking about themselves. And the next day in New York City, there was sort of a long extended period of show and tell in the kids in New York City. And again, I'm not accusing anyone of looting. It just seems that everybody's uncle found the perfect pair of shoes in their nephew's
right.
niece and nephew's size that
well,
day.
Well, the DJ Grandmaster Kaz himself says that he obtained by looting a mixer that got him. He's the guy who thought maybe he'd cause the blackout once he realized he hadn't. He actually got a mixer out of this whole process. Hey, we're going to have to stop there, but we've had a reporting here from Carmen Baskoff and Brendan J. Sullivan. I would like to point out that their combined ages would still fall short of my age. I don't know how to feel about that, but excellent reporting from people on the scene in New York City about the blackout. We still don't exactly know 100% what caused this blackout. They say it's not terrorism or anything like that, but so details to come. We have to take a break, and we will come back, and we will tell you about a whole different subject, that subject being baseball.
Hello? Hello? Is this mic switch on? It's pitch black in here. I can't really read the credits. Today's show is produced by Sarah Bareilles? Could that be right? Sandra Bull. Scott Breedy. That's who it must be. And me, Kyone Wolf. Our interns are Jesse Steinmetz and Carolyn McCusker. The part of Brian Cranston was played by Benedict Cumberbatch. That also seems very wrong. Anyway, tomorrow's show is about snot. No, sand. Okay, I gotta go. Whoa! I'm okay.
All right. It was very dark in there. We had a little blackout of our own. So joining us now, let me just sort of set this up to say that, for example, quite recently in London, for the first time ever, there was two Major League Baseball games between the Yankees and the Red Sox. Much excitement about that. But the first of those games wound up being, I believe, the third longest nine-inning baseball game in the history of Major League Baseball. It took a really long time to watch. And it's things like that that have caused our next guest, Dave Zirin, political sports writer, sports editor at The Nation, and host of its Edge of Sports podcast, to wonder if that has anything to do or what has anything to do with what appears to be a declining audience for baseball. Dave Zirin, welcome back to our show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So set this up a little bit more for us. You're asking this question about declining enthusiasm for the former national pastime. Why?
Well, because Gallup took a poll about is baseball your favorite sport, and it received the lowest numbers since Gallup started asking the question, which was during the Great Depression. So we're going back over 80 years. Baseball's never had a lower number of sport. It's 9% of people in the United States believe that baseball is their favorite sport. I mean, you put that up against football, which is in the high 30s, for example. I mean, it's not even in the same stratosphere. Making it even more difficult for baseball is the percentage of fans who are over age 55 has never been higher. The percentage of fans who are under 18 have never been lower. So statistically, it's trending wrong in every conceivable direction. And that, I think, should provoke a great amount of existential worry for the future of the sport.
But it doesn't seem to, right? For example, everybody knows the games are too long. One of Major League Baseball's tweaks was to knock literally 5 seconds off the period between innings, the changeover between innings. I mean, 5 seconds is not going to fix a problem that we might call four-hour baseball games.
No, it's not going to fix the problem, particularly when baseball games a generation ago were roughly an hour shorter than they are now. I mean, and so we could talk about all the reasons why games are, some of it is commercialism, some of it is the way the game is coached and the way the game is played, pitching changes. There are all sorts of things that have made it a longer product. But this longer product, 162 games a year, for more people seems like a chore than it does an act of fun. And one of the things that provoked me to write this article wasn't just my own dwindling enthusiasm for a sport that I was obsessed with growing up. It's also because some of the great profilers of the sport, some of the great champions of the sport, people like Tim Kirkchin over at ESPN, who's been a diehard baseball fan for 60 years. He likes to point out that he went to Walter Johnson High School in Bethesda, Maryland. That's how much of a fan he is. He said he's never enjoyed the sport less. He's unhappy watching the sport. These kinds of things have provoked me to want to ask these questions.
So this wouldn't be a Dave Zirin interview without us asking about the latent politics and economics of this. One of the reasons that they're not in a hurry to fix this, this is the engine light blinking on the dashboard saying, go get service immediately. But they don't really have to do this because of the way their industry is structured. Say more about that.
Exactly. It's hard to think of a business that's sort of more awash in corporate welfare than Major League Baseball. Whether you're talking about the amount of money that's received for stadiums, whether you're talking about public subsidies, or whether you're talking about sweetheart cable deals that they get because local cable companies are in so much regional partnership now and they're not shown on regular television. And those can be as much as billion-dollar deals as it is for the Los Angeles Dodgers, or even $100 million deals as it is in smaller markets like Baltimore. So they're getting all of this money infused into their system. And so they're saying, hey, why should we change anything? You know, we're riding fat on the hog here with all the money that's coming in through public subsidies and through the cable deals. But what they're not looking at, and what they need to be looking at, is where is the fan enthusiasm for people who aren't going to be accepting Social Security in a few years? That should be their bigger concern, because if there's one thing we know about sports history in this country, it's that what is not always what will be. There were times where boxing and horse racing, these were the most popular sports in the country. sports have cycles. Sports can come and go. And I don't think Major League Baseball is taking it nearly seriously enough, the kind of precipice that they're facing.
I just want to put a little asterisk on one thing you said. It's hard to think of a sport that's or an activity that's more gets more corporate welfare than a Major League Baseball. I would nominate Minor League Baseball, where I live in Hartford, where the city built them a stadium. But the owners of the Minor League Baseball teams, they don't even have to pay salaries to players. Those are all paid by the Major League teams. You just collect money if you are a Minor League Baseball owner. Somebody else builds you a stadium and pays for it, and you just collect money. So it's an even better deal. But it does feel as though there's some kind of cliff that they'll hit, or some point of diminishing returns anyway. This is a boring game. The games go on way too long. I mean, I love baseball too. I was trying to watch the Red Sox Dodgers game last night, although it was 5 hours and 40 minutes in extra innings, and I did give up. But I mean, at some point, something will grab them by the shoulders. And what do they do then, Dave?
Exactly. But the question is going to be, will it be too late by that point? Because you're absolutely right. At some point, the cable companies are going to be seeing too many diminishing returns. There's already far less of an appetite among the populace to be paying for these stadiums than there was a generation ago. So they are going to hit these diminishing returns. And then there's going to have to be in a real rush to ask themselves, how can we have a product that's consistently entertaining and consistently roughly 2.5 hours long? And they're going to have to come up with some drastic changes to what is a sport, more than any other, that's so deeply tied to tradition and to the way things have always been.
Right. And one of the things I think that they've done, I mean, I think most of us are pretty comfortable with the idea that the ball is juiced right now. The ball is jumping out of ballparks at unprecedented rates. And Major League Baseball has sort of kind of said, yeah, kind of, there is maybe a difference in the ball, but not really. Or they have been very muddy about this whole thing. But the notion that dingers, you know, are going to mesmerize us forever. I mean, all home runs kind of look the same as opposed to like a triple, which looks really different, or a stolen base or something like that.
Exactly. And by juicing the ball, which they have assuredly done, what they've done is that they've changed strategies by major league managers who say, well, what's the point in doing a sacrifice bunt? What's the point in sacrificing an out to move a base stealer along? What's the point in risking an out by stealing a base if you could clear all the bases with just one swing? So you not only have more home runs, you have more strikeouts, less fielding opportunities, and lower batting averages. And all of these things work together to create a different kind of a sport.
I think it changes the psychology of the players, too. Everybody thinks that he's Aaron Judge. It's appropriate for Aaron Judge to swing really hard at everything because a lot of those things are going to go out. But last night I watched the Red Sox get up in the eighth, and the first two batters hit home runs on the first pitch that they got. The next three batters, you know, made no attempt to do anything other than I mean, the fever had gotten into them. It's hard to tell a baseball player not to swing for the bleachers.
Right, especially when they're getting managerial approval to do it. I think this, I mean, I'm going to sound very old right now, but I think some of the real old school managers, like the Billy Martins of the world, must be turning over in their graves at not seeing stolen bases, hit and runs, ground ball pitchers. That's another thing that's going the way of the dinosaur, the idea of the beautiful junk ball pitcher who can get other teams up. Star players to hit in the double plays, all of these things that were staples of the sport, they've changed, which is why, like people like myself who want to see a change in the sport, sometimes we're referred to as radicals and not traditionalists, when I think we're the actual traditionalists, because we want to return the game to a degree to what it was, while I think the owners who are juicing the ball are the real radicals.
Yes. All right, we're going to have to stop there, but read more of Dave Zirin, a political sports writer, sports editor at The Nation. Listen to his podcast, The Edge of Sports Podcast. Check this piece out in The Nation that inspired all this. And thanks to everybody who worked on today's show, especially Scott Breedy, who got it all together for us on a very busy Sunday.